Hey, everybody, and welcome back to our podcast on statistics for the social sciences. Jenny here, glad to be talking with you again, and today we have a fairly short episode. We're going to be talking about the quality of our data and information, and we're going to hinge that on two really big key concepts, reliability and validity. Up to this point in our course, we have been focusing on how we can describe our data using things like the measures of central tendency or thinking about things like variation. So where is the middle of our data set and how spread out is it? We use graphing to look at it, to really visualize what does the data show, what does it tell us. Maybe we just look at a histogram to figure out what is the distribution of our data in terms of like how often do certain values show up in the data set. And then in our last episode, we talked about correlation, which is a way of thinking about how the data moves together. Specifically, we usually look at this with two separate variables in a scatter plot. So it like kind of looks like the graphs we grew up understanding and evaluating through maybe middle school, high school, somewhere in there, where you look at a bunch of dots and we try to fit a line through. So again, those are all ways of describing or thinking about our data. Correlation in particular helps us think about the relationships in our data. But all of this assumes that we have good quality data that we're working with, and we need to be really careful about that because it's not always the case. And in fact, we do need to pay close attention to how we are measuring our data or our variables. Thinking here about variables again, how are we measuring each of the things we're interested in? And are those measures consistent, aka reliable, as well as are they accurate, aka valid? So that's what we're going to be talking about today. What are we looking at in order to establish whether our measurements are consistent and accurate? In place of the word consistency, we're going to use the term reliability. And in place of the accurate term, we're going to use valid. Just in case you haven't at this point, please go ahead and make your way back to the Week 5 Roadmap page, and let's open up the slides on reliability and validity. You'll see once you have those open, we've only got 17 slides to talk about. So this isn't a super in-depth chapter in terms of needing to spend a huge amount of time on it, but I will be asking a question on the midterm related to something around reliability and validity. I do want you to make sure you have a solid grasp of the basic terms. We're going to talk about some specific measures of reliability and validity, things like inter-rater reliability or the Cronbach alpha for internal consistency. And then we also have different types of validity. I'm more concerned that you just get the general gist of the big concepts, and then you can connect that to those different types of measures. As in, if I'm worried about my validity and I'm thinking about whether I'm covering all of the things that I need to cover in a measure, what kind of validity am I missing? We're going to practice that just a little bit at the end of this set of slides, but our objectives with all of the slides and with this brief episode, which I anticipate will be less than 30 minutes, is to get the general understandings, definitions, and some examples of each of the terms. So without any further delay, let's jump in. And I'm going to jump in by having you actually look at a visual. If you check out slide 4, what I've given is what's called the target analogy. And the target analogy is if we were to create a picture that shows what we mean by reliability and validity, and we were to use a target as the, let's say, visualization, this is what it would look like. So what we want is the bottom right-hand target. That is the one that has both reliability and validity, because you can see, and I'm going to use the example of a bow and arrow, because that's actually what I've done in my spare time is I do a little bit of archery. It's been a long time, so there's no way I can shoot very well anymore. But if I was accurate and I was consistent, you would see the arrows creating the holes in the bottom right-hand picture, the bottom right-hand target. You see how they're all centered in the middle? That's what makes it valid. They're centered on the middle of the target, and then they're grouped closely together. And that's consistency or reliability. The top left-hand target, I'm off, and I'm nowhere really around the center, nor am I shooting in one consistent area. That's a really bad place to be. Particularly for archery, that's a very frustrating place. Now, let's say I'm in the top right-hand target. Well, I'm somewhat more valid because if you were to put a center to all of those different dots, all of the different arrows, it would be in the middle, right? It's just very unreliable because I'm hitting all over the target and I'm not coming anywhere near the middle consistently. The bottom left-hand target is actually not a bad one, except that it's not centered in the middle. But I am so much more consistent there, right? Like I'm hitting the same area over and over and over again. And if we were measuring something, that means we're consistently getting the same kinds of results, but it's not an accurate result. What we want is the bottom right-hand target. So if we have both reliable and valid measures of our variables, not only are we getting the same measure over and over again, the consistency, but it's actually measuring things the right way, which makes it valid and accurate. The technical definition of reliability is probably more than we need to worry about. So on slide 5, what I've presented to you is the layman's terms definition. And that's when whatever tool you're using to measure something gives you the same results consistently when working with the same input. So here's my example. I'm going to use the examples of turtles. Don't know if I've done these in the podcast before. I believe so. But if not, I will be using them again in the future. So I have a turtle. And I weigh the turtle. And the turtle weighs 295 pounds on my scale. And I take the turtle off, and 5 minutes later, I put the turtle on the same scale, and it shows as 295 pounds. And let's say I do this all day long with not feeding the turtle anything additional, and the turtle doesn't seem to lose any weight from like dehydration or anything like that. When my scale shows 295 over and over and over again, that's a reliable measure, okay? That is good. That means my scale is consistent. Now, I'm going to think about another example, and I've got it listed here on the slide. What if I'm asking a question about attitudes? Let's say attitudes towards statistics or education. If I ask the question to one person, and that one person gives the same answer each time I ask the question, that's a consistent measure. So my question is written in such a way that it gives me a consistent response. That's good. Again, if it holds over time, if the answers stay the same to the question, if my weight values stay the same using that scale for my turtles, those are reliable measures. Reliable measuring systems, at the very least. Now, we definitely have different types of reliability when we're thinking about doing our measuring. So we have ways to assess whether something's consistent. And these are different options, and they're going to kind of analyze different things. So the types of reliability are listed on slide 6. And really what I want you to do here is fill in what is the definition of each type of reliability, and then how do we calculate it? As in, how would I do this? So we'll use the first line, and I'll pretty much give you what fills in there. Test-retest reliability is essentially giving a person the same test multiple times or testing something using the same test more than once. And you calculate it just by looking at how do the scores on your test correlate with one another over time. The way we do this, we give a test at a certain time, let's say on a Monday, and the students take the test, and then we give them the same test on Friday. And we look at, are they highly correlated? Are the scores highly correlated? Meaning, do the test scores look pretty much the same on Monday and Friday, or do they look different? And if they look different, we might have a problem with consistency. Assuming we didn't do anything between Monday and Friday to make changes in how people would understand the contents of that test or answer the questions. Now, generally, I experienced this in school when we did like English testing for grammar and spelling. They would do a pre-test on Monday, then we'd do a lesson in the week, and then on Friday we'd take a post-test to figure out, did our understanding of the spelling of the words and the grammar change? But with test-retest reliability, all we're doing is trying to figure out, does the test give us the same responses at two different times? Or do the people taking the test, that is, give us the same responses over two different times? Now that's one example using people, but I could do the same thing with a variable. Again, think of my scale. Does my scale give me the same weight for the turtle 5 minutes ago as it does right now? And if it does, that's consistency. That's reliability. And we're using test retest to figure that out. So now I want you to go ahead and try and fill out the rest of this slide. Define what parallel forms is, what internal consistency is, and what inter-rater reliability is, and then how would you calculate them, or how do they describe calculating them? And if you can't find this in your textbook, go ahead and do some searching. Don't just look at the first Google result, but look at a couple of different pages to make sure that you fully understand how would we figure this out. And I'm going to tell you a lot of it's going to have to do with correlation. Correlation telling us how well do our measures correlate with either itself or with other possible measures we could use to assess our variables. If you have any questions or run into any problems while you're filling this out, of course, email me, and I'm happy to look over anything you create and say, yep, that looks right. Or perhaps something that you've written maybe looks a little bit different than what I would expect to see. One of the measures that we can actually use SPSS for, and we can use SPSS in a lot of ways to assess reliability, but one of the easiest to do is known as Cronbach's alpha. And Cronbach's alpha is tied to internal consistency. So when you see internal consistency listed on the slide before, this is one of the measures that can help us figure out if something's internally consistent. Now, the formula for this is absolutely awful. I mean, if you really want to see it, check out page 111. I'm looking at slide 7, by the way, when I read this. Really, it's saying we're going to correlate the score for every item with a total score for all the people taking the test, comparing that with all the variability, and that makes for a very ugly, almost evil-looking formula. It's really not something I would take lightly, and certainly not something I would calculate by hand. So why don't you take a moment here and do some practice? Let's use SPSS to solve the problem listed on page 112. Okay, so it runs from page 112 to 113. The data you'll need to enter is the table that is listed beneath the heading of Computing Cronbach's Alpha, just before the section on using SPSS to calculate Cronbach's Alpha. That table will have columns for ID, item 1, item 2, item 3, item 4, and item 5. You do not need to enter a column for total score, because that's not something we're going to be typing in here. And you don't need to enter any columns for, or any rows, excuse me, for item variance. Just the original listing with the sample data for 10 people on the 5-item attitude test. Again, under the heading of Computing Cronbach's Alpha, that appears to be listed as on page 110 in the electronic copy of the book. But if you really run into problems, let me know. I'll try to help you out with that as well. Doing work like what I'm talking about with this problem, it's the kind of practice I want you to get used to and to constantly employ as you are proceeding through this course. These types of problems help us to better learn SPSS and also how to more effectively utilize what is in our textbook in terms of what are the instructions saying and what are the steps I need to take, as well as what is the book showing me and explaining to me from SPSS. Now here's where it gets a little wonky. Sometimes, and recently I've seen this a bit more frequently, there are updates to SPSS, and so our textbook is not going to have the exact same look as what you will see in the program. When you run into that, I want you to reach out and let me know if you're not able to figure out what our next steps are. But I would dare say so much of the change is kind of surface level, it's not hugely different, so usually the functions that you see on the top menu for SPSS are pretty similar. Now, where it does get somewhat different or significantly different is when it goes to what are called these legacy dialogues, which is how it keeps the old structures that maybe it had for, let's say, graphs in the past. That is definitely messy. And I do want you to let me know when you run into hiccups there, because sometimes it takes a while to figure out. And in fact, a few of those things have taken me more than a day to try and put together, even with doing research, you know, using basic Google searches and going through several websites. If you have that, let me know. But for right now, go ahead and take a break in this podcast. Do that Cronbox Alpha practice. And if your results match the book, awesome. Please then proceed. If for some reason you don't get the same thing as what's in the book, first, go back and retrace your steps. Did we do all of the same things that they said to do in the book, or did we follow all the same steps? Did we miss a step? If your steps were the exact same and somehow you ended up in a different place at the very end, do reach out and let me know, and I will try to assist as best I can in terms of walking back where we should be from where we were at the beginning with that problem. All right, at this point, I'm going to proceed as if you did that calculation and the practice problem. If not, I understand, but I do really think it's valuable. So setting that aside, when we get a Cronbox Alpha calculation, we can look at slide 9 to determine, is this an internally consistent tool or measure that we're using? Anything above 0.9 is excellent. It's got a lot of internal consistency, meaning we're probably asking about the right things, as in they all relate to one another. Whatever measure we're using is consistently, meaning regularly getting at what we want to measure, or we're hoping that's the case. Either way, it's consistently getting at one thing. Now, if it's between 0.9 and 0.8, we're in good range. Above 0.7, it's acceptable. And below that, we're not in a good place. Go back to those results. You just calculated an SPSS. 0.239, which is what they're showing, oh, that's pretty abysmal. That's terrible. It's, in fact, on this table, not even really listed as anything other than unacceptable. So our items from that data set do not line up with one another, and we need to think about what we're putting on that test, because clearly we're not getting at what we want to get at. It's not consistent. Now, let's say we did a second or different version of reliability known as inter-rater reliability. Inter-rater reliability, I hope you've gone ahead and defined, you know, how consistently do two or more people quote-unquote score or measure something. Are they doing it in the same way, or are they doing it very differently? And for inter-rater reliability, again, you want something pretty high. Above a 0.9 is great. Above a 0.8 is great. Above a 0.6 is okay, you know, if it's not up to a 0.8. And below that, we have a problem. We're saying people aren't measuring things in the same way, at least with inter-rater reliability. And think about the word. Break it down into parts. Inter, as in between, and rater, as in between people or between the individuals doing the rating, okay? So that is the measures of how well two different or more than two different people score something or understand something or measure something. And we're really hoping at least 0.8 or greater so that we feel like regardless of who's doing the work, it's consistently being measured. Okay, that takes us all the way from reliability into the realm of validity. And validity, I'm going to again do the layman's terms description and not the technical definition. It's when what you are measuring is what you intended to measure. Okay, that sounds a little weird, but it's like getting on a scale and getting your accurate weight. It's not getting the weight that perhaps you wish you were or a weight that's way far off. It's accuracy. So if I'm weighing my turtle and the turtle should weigh 295 pounds, the number it shows is 295. Not 305, not 315, not 105, but accurately showing what the weight truly is. If I think of this in the other example where I'm asking the question about attitudes on, let's say, education, I want it to actually be measuring the attitude on education, not the attitudes about a teacher, not the attitudes about a specific class, not even the attitudes about a specific school. It needs to be about education generally. So if I'm not measuring or assessing that with my measure, I'm missing something here. I'm not writing the question in the right way to get at what I want. So I'm not measuring what I intended to measure in that case. This is very, very difficult sometimes in social sciences, particularly when we do surveys. Let me continue with that example. So if I were to ask you a question about how you feel about statistics, I may not be getting your actual feelings about statistics. I might be getting your feelings about the professor, because you may not be able easily to know in that question that I'm asking you to separate out how you feel about the material versus how you feel about the instructor. And frankly, oftentimes those two things go hand in hand. I can tell you for sure. For me, in college, there were a lot of classes I felt negatively about because I felt negatively about the instructor or the professor. Perhaps there was something there that made me really change my opinion of the field. Or maybe it was just that I didn't like being in that class. Like, that sounds terrible because I am a professor now and I don't want anyone to feel that way in my courses, but I can honestly say I did feel that in certain classes. So in those situations, I walked out of that class having a specific attitude about the material that was more a reflection of how I felt about the person teaching it than about the material itself. There were some courses I just couldn't stay awake for, and y'all, statistics was one of them. So I'm hoping that's not the case for you, but that was true for me, and it made me feel negatively about statistics, at least until I got the chance to do something more proactive, go to graduate school, and teach myself a bit about it, and get really into the nuts and bolts of it. So again, thinking about social statistics, we have to be really clear with people what our questions are asking about if we're doing something like an interview or a survey. Are we actually measuring what we intend to measure? And related to that, on slide 12, you're going to see that there are three different types of validity that we can use to know whether we're getting at what we want to get at. These three types are content-based, criterion-based, and construct-based. As I asked you to with reliability, I want you to define these. When I say what, as in on slide 12, what is content-based? Explain what it is. And then how it's calculated, how do we figure out if we've got content-based validity? Or how do we figure out if we've got criterion-based validity? How do we figure out if we've got construct-based validity? These are quite a bit harder, in my opinion, than reliability, because reliability is about consistency. But let's say you want to measure something like anger or aggression. Wow, how do you know that you're actually getting at aggression? Is it something you can observe? Is it something you just have to ask about? What about something more indefinite, like sadness or depression? How are we going to know that if we're asking people about it and trying to measure it? How do we make sure we're getting at what we want to actually measure? I can ask you if you feel sad. Right, that's a great question, but that doesn't necessarily tell me if you're depressed. I would need to ask many more questions to assess and measure if what your sadness level is lines up with, let's say, depression. So those are all things I want you to keep in mind. And then I want you to go through the next three slides and try to identify which is the most likely kind of validity that you are missing with those examples. So slide 13 reads as, I give a test to my criminal courts class. The test scores come back and show that the group has overwhelmingly failed, at least on this test. But when I talk to other professors about those students and how they did just terribly on this exam, those professors tell me that the students have good conversations with them about courts, and they understand what's going on. So what validity is my test missing here? The one that shows that everyone fails. And what I'm going to tell you is it's not always quite so easy to tie this in, but it's very particular when I ask the question in that way, that I'm using a different type of measure to assess validity, okay? So think about which of these types of validity is about using another measure or another method, to assess whether I'm measuring what I should be measuring. Now, example number two, what kind of validity am I missing? This ties back to what I talked about before. I'm assessing a person's level of depression on a survey, and I ask someone how they feel about statistics, or when they think about statistics, how do they feel, if they watch the news, and whether they're in sports. And then I can see that those questions don't really line up with whether they say they have depression or not. I can see the questions don't match. Considering the three types of validity, which one seems to be the most likely that's missing here? And I want you to think here about, we're trying to measure some underlying thing tied into psychology. Which type of validity connects back to that? The last example for me is the easiest just because I think it most clearly reflects the definition of the term. Let's say I give you all a test on statistics, which we're going to get to fairly soon here. And I only cover chapter 4 on graphing and chapter 6 on reliability and validity. Well, this means I don't have the full universe of items. So which type of validity is missing from that exam? And with that, we are done with our discussions of reliability and validity. Very brief topic, generally speaking, but quite important because if we have bad data, we're going to get bad results. And one of the weird ways I've always heard this described in statistics is garbage in, garbage out, meaning if you have bad data that you put in, the results you're going to get aren't going to help you understand anything. Essentially, think about this. You study a sample of people and our measures are really bad. Well, then you can't conclude anything about the larger population and you won't get an answer to the research question that you're most interested in. That's where we leave it if we don't have good reliability and good validity. And it calls into question a lot of what we do as far as research. And that is a good question to ask. I think that's really important. We have more and more studies showing we can't recreate the results that we find in different scientific studies, which leads people to question science. I get that. I don't want people to have to think that the scientific method is not a good one, because in my experience, it's quite effective and it's quite good at answering the questions. But if our measures are bad, well, that's simply going to leave us without any good results and a feeling of a lack of confidence in what we learn or what we supposedly know from science. So pay attention to those things and particularly think about how that would relate to your research question. On that note, I want to set aside this little conversation about your research papers, because several of you have been in contact with me related to prior podcasts, and I love that you've let me know what your variables are. For anyone doing research or proposing research, let's say on a sensitive topic, you, as far as your paper, are not going to be responsible for finding raw data on that topic. For example, anything related to mental health or mental illness, that's largely protected data. So what will happen for your final paper is that I will create a fake data set for you. And I'll do that for anyone in this course. If you're having a hard time finding what's known as raw data, and by raw data, I literally mean those tables of numbers. If you can't find tables of raw numbers, like surveys or interviews or just measures of different statistics, let's say on anything you want to evaluate in your research question, don't worry, you'll be fine for the final paper. I will create a fake data set for you. I've been doing this now for a couple of years for students in this course, and I don't want you to freak out at the thought of not being able to find your own data. If you are able to find raw data on your topic, that's awesome, because that means you can actually investigate your research question and have an answer that isn't from a fake data set, meaning we can learn more about the population. But I want you in no way to worry about that. So if you have concerns about that, reach out, let me know now, and we can connect on that. Aside from that announcement, please keep in mind, SPSS Assignment 2 is going to be coming due for you very soon. If you're running into challenges with that, particularly question number 2, I will be posting something during the week to give guidance on the steps for completing that bar graph. It's a hard one. That's one of those questions that literally took me 3 days to figure out what the right steps were. And so I don't want you to suffer like that. If you've worked on it for a while and you're not making any forward progress, take a look at those notes. Those should be available by Wednesday. And then for next time, for our next podcast episode, please read through chapter 7 called Hypotheticals and You. We're going to be talking about the research process, the scientific process, linking that back to statistics, and hopefully furthering our conversation around things like our research papers. Well, that does it for me today. please don't ever hesitate to email me with questions or concerns at jemille@wsc.edu. And I look forward to speaking with you again very soon.